It is my pleasure to have on my next guest. He is the Democratic nominee for the United States Senate out of the great state of Michigan. He is a physician, and a Rhodes Scholar. He led Detroit's Health Department and Wayne County's Department of Health, Human, and Veteran Services. He recently defeated Representative Haley Stevens by roughly 15,000 votes, less than one percentage point, but the bottom line is he got it done. And he now faces former Republican Congressman Mike Rogers for the seat being vacated by retiring Senator Gary Peters. Please welcome for the first time to Straight Shooter, Dr. Abdul El Sayed. How you doing, Doc? How's everything going? What may I call you, first of all? Let me ask you what you would like me to call you.
Abdul is perfect. And I got to tell you, I grew up watching you. So this is a bit of a pinch yourself kind of moment. You know, when you run these races, you're so busy. And there are moments that you're just like, man, I'm talking to Stephen A. Smith. So, hey, grateful to be on, grateful for you and the work that you do both, you know, teaching us about the part of sports we don't always pay attention to, and also just taking that to the political conversation. So honored to be here.
I appreciate it, man. Thank you so much. So let's get right to it. Why are you the best candidate for the state of Michigan, and why should you be in the United States Senate? How would you answer that question?
My entire career has been about taking care of people. I trained to be a doctor only to realize that the healthcare system I was trained to be a part of was not just not part of the solution, it was too often part of the problem. Watch people get denied the healthcare that they needed in large part because they couldn't pay for it in the richest, most powerful country in the world. I went into public health to take on the structures that get people sick in the first place, rebuilt Detroit's health department, led Wayne County's Department of Health, Human, and Veteran Services. We did things like put glasses on kids' faces, take on some of the biggest corporate polluters in our state, eliminated medical debt, put Narcan in vending machines for free, provided free health insurance, made sure our kids weren't exposed to lead in their schools after the Flint water crisis. And I'm running because I understand that the structure of our politics is in part the problem, right? Trump is not himself the disease. He's just the worst symptom of the disease. The disease is the way that big corporations and billionaires and special interests can buy and sell politicians to do their bidding instead of ours. We're running a campaign to get money out of politics, put money in your pocket, pass Medicare for All. I got outspent 11-1, $70 million of outside spending against us. But because we had a message that we took everywhere, we brought to everyone, we are clear, honest, and direct, say the same thing to everybody. People saw the difference. Do you want your politics corporatized and corrupted, or do you want your politics for you, by you, and of you?
Well, how are you going to change that based on everything you just said? How are you going to change that when you're one of 100 senators?
Well, I think in politics, it's not just about you being one of 100 senators. It's not just your vote. It's the platform that you carry. You know, Michigan is one of the most important states on the electoral map. It's the most important state in the country. You knew I was going to say that. But yes, it's the one people pay attention to because, number one, we're going to be the first large swing state on the primary map. And then, you know, we are a critical swing state people have to pay attention to if you want to win the presidency. And so in winning here, in the way that I won, I've never taken a dime of corporate money, never have, never will. In winning this way, we're proving out that you can actually beat the system if you're willing to be honest, specific, and direct about the issues that people care about. And what that's going to do is start moving the public conversation. Now, I'm going to be out here as Michigan's next U.S. senator advocating for union rights, advocating for guaranteed health care, advocating against corporate interests, taking on monopolies and oligopolies that charge us too much or pay us too little. And I think it's going to have a huge impact on the way that especially Democrats, but frankly, everyone's asking, well, why can't I have a senator that sounds like that? Why won't my senator fight against the corporations instead of taking money from the corporations when they're raising prices on me in ways that I can't afford? And I think it's about the conversation that we have, not just with 99 other senators, but with the 350 million people that elect all of us, which is in part why I'm here with you, Stephen, because I want to have that conversation about what our politics really can be.
Forgive the obvious question, but I know the answer, but I'm going to ask it anyway. Are you a socialist?
I'm not. I'm a capitalist who just understands capitalism. Right. No, look, you know, the term capitalism, it was coined by a guy named Adam Smith. And Adam Smith said, there is no market without morals. He also said that the biggest danger to capitalism was not government regulation, it was monopoly. And you think about all the stuff you got to buy, right? Chances are almost everybody who's listening has got a phone in their pocket. That phone's probably made by one of two manufacturers, got one of three carriers. Let's say instead of calling people, you decide you go visit grandma in another state. You're probably flying on one of three carriers, on one of two kinds of planes, Boeing or Airbus. We've got monopolies and oligopolies up and down our economy. It is anti-capitalist. Capitalism is just using supply and demand to allocate where scarce resources ought to go. I believe in that, but I don't believe that it was intended to allow huge corporations to dominate any given market. And even worse, to use their money to help pick the people who are supposed to regulate them so that they get bought off to turn the other way when it comes to choices that they make. And in the end, I believe in a market. And that's why I believe we've got to regulate these corporations and make sure they're not buying politicians.
Talking to Democratic nominee for the United States Senate out of the great state of Michigan, Abdul El Sayed, right here with Straight Shooter with Stephen A. I would ask you this. If elected, you would become the first Muslim U.S. senator. Clearly, when we look at a lot of things going on in this country, we've seen the fomenting, the growing, the proliferation of anti-Semitism. At least some people would say that. First order of business, do you believe Israel has a right to exist as a Jewish state?
I believe in equal rights to peace, dignity, and self-determination for Palestinians and Jewish Israelis alike. I believe the responsibility we have is to make sure that our tax dollars aren't being used to foreclose on the possibility of Palestinian self-determination as that's happening right now. So I believe in whatever solution free Palestinian people and free Jewish Israeli people come to about how that ought to work. But here's what else I believe. Right now, we're spending billions of our tax dollars taking our money, sending it to a foreign government that's done awful things, maintained an apartheid, done a genocide, is fomenting and driving a war effort in Iran. When we've got kids down the street, for most of us, who go to schools that look like they did 50 years ago. And I think they have the right to their tax dollars. And we have a responsibility to be using our money here rather than sending it over there to drop bombs on other people and their kids. It's really not that hard. And at the end of the day, I am interested in whatever solution folks come together. They say they want a two-state solution, great. If they say they want a one-state solution, fine. If they say they want a 23-state solution or a land for all solution, fine. But as the next senator from Michigan, my responsibility is to Michigan, to build schools in Michigan, to provide health care in Michigan, to make sure that we got roads in Michigan.
I get that. But you know, sir, that I mean, it's about, at some point, it's about you. It's not just about your intent, because a lot of people can spew what their intent is. And I'm not here to question that. I'm taking you at your word. You mean every damn thing that you say. I'm not here to debate that. You know, this is a platform where we can just have a discussion. But what I'm saying is it would cause an elevated level of suspicion. Like I just asked you the question. I understand your point. I want to let you answer it. But I'm still going to come back to the same question. Does that mean yes? That you're supportive of Israel as a Jewish state? Does that mean yes or no? Or is it contingent on whether or not Palestinian, they were able to provide a two-state solution? What's the answer to that question?
Stephen A., you're getting to the exact nut of the issue here.
Okay.
The challenge that I often have when people ask that question is it's meant to frame around the way that Israel currently exists right now. We've been told by every American president that we believe in a two-state solution. But nobody ever asked me, does Palestine have a right to exist? Israel exists, but Palestine doesn't. Except for we're sending our tax dollars to aid, arm, and abet a Israeli leadership right now that wants to foreclose on the possibility of a Palestinian state at all. And so we need to get to a point where Jewish Israeli kids and Palestinian kids no longer have to fear what happens to them. And the only way you do that is to create a system by which you enable both of these communities to come together to negotiate how this ought to look like. And the problem that I often have is when you ask me that question, people say, well, you know, to what end? Like, what does it mean to have a Jewish state? Does it mean Jewish by leadership? Does it mean Jewish by majority? Does it mean that the president has to be Jewish? And what do you then do with the possibility of Palestinian self-determination as this Jewish currently existing state is leveraging its power to extend settlements into parts of the West Bank, has annihilated Gaza. It is now annihilating and potentially trying to annex southern Lebanon. So I just think we have to have a conversation that doesn't start with the question of states. It starts with the question of self-determination.
Well, I guess,
and then we enable people to make those decisions about how that ought to look like in the long term.
For me, what I'll pride myself on this platform, sir, is that to me, there's no problem with the question. There's problem when you don't give somebody an opportunity to answer it, because I've seen you on various shows and you got people ready to cut you off in 30 seconds. Notice I didn't do that. I let you speak. You see what I'm saying? So I asked you the question, but I'm giving you that real estate to give a complete answer. So I'm good with that. But let me ask you this further. Let me stay on this subject before I move on, because I got some questions about ICE and some other things as well. After a Temple Israel attack, you condemned the violence but added that hurt people hurt people. In April, you again said events overseas can affect life in Michigan. You apologized more than 5 months after the attack, but that was after the primary. Why did it take 5 months and until after the primary for you to apologize?
No, after the primary, I spent some time really listening to members of the Jewish community and some of the frustrations they had. We're going to have to agree to disagree when it comes to foreign policy. And a lot of folks in the community who just don't agree with me on Israel, and I understand that.
Got it.
But they also said, look, it felt like you were justifying an attack against our community, and there should never be an asterisk on our pain. And I said, you know what, you're right. There should never be an asterisk on your pain. And that was not in what I intended in the statement. I had fully disavowed the terrorist attack, but I wanted to offer context, and it just wasn't the right thing to do in a moment. And I can understand from this vantage point why it felt like I was putting an asterisk on that pain. And so when it comes to my commitment to Jewish safety, I want to be clear. My commitment to the safety of Jewish children and Jewish families is the same as the commitment that I got to the safety of my kids and my family. And it should be a right to live safely, to advocate for what you believe in without having to worry about what then will happen to the sanctity of your family. That is what democracy is about. And I'll always be standing for that. And I wanted the Jewish community to know that I recognized why that was painful to folks. And so we can deeply disagree on how we ought to get equal rights of peace, dignity, and self-determination for Palestinians and Jewish Israelis in the Holy Land. But I will never question whether or not Jewish communities and Jewish families and Jewish children should be safe in our land. And that is a commitment that I hold dear, and I wanted folks to understand that.
Last question on this particular subject, and this, you know, I was going to let you on this show and not ask you about Hassan Piker. I got to ask you about him, because that's a wild man right there. You could, I mean, you've condemned rhetoric suggesting American Jews could provoke violence against themselves, but you've resisted demands to repudiate Hassan Piker personally, who obviously has been a supporter of yours. You've been seen with him on the campaign. I'm asking you this. Is there anything Hassan Piker could say that would make you publicly disavow him, considering what he has said about the Jewish community?
I mean, sure, but the bigger question is this: how do we want to exchange ideas? And the big question that I often want us to be stepping back and asking is, what is democracy for? Right? The idea that you just categorically disavow an individual, that to me doesn't make sense, given that there are going to be things that people say that you deeply disagree with.
Even
you
one
disavow
that says
those things.
That America brought 9/11 on itself. Even that.
And then he disavowed it. And then he disavowed it himself. Stephen A., like, that's not a consistent reading of what the man actually thinks. He specifically said that he was wrong about that himself. And look, I've been a student of Stephen A. Smith long enough to know that people have come after you and tried to cancel you for stuff that you said. So do you think people should disavow you for the worst, like the things that you might have said on the air that didn't come out quite right, or they clipped out of context?
I would say to answer your question directly, I would say yes if I went that damn far, because nobody could ever say I did something like that, sir.
And
they can't
what
say
I'm
that.
Saying is, what I'm saying is there are 3 million people who listen to Hassan.
Understood.
And I want to offer them a pathway into an electoral movement where, rather than sit us outside of the electoral system, they see a pathway around the things that they agree with that he says, that I agree with, and a pathway that disavows the things that I disagree with. And so it's important.
So you're not thinking
right?
about him. You're not thinking about him. You're thinking about the 3 million people that support him, and you're trying to get those votes. That's what you're saying?
Exactly. And let me just be clear. Like, I've been watching you for a very long time, and I'm glad to be on your show.
Sure.
But I'm not here to talk to you. You know this.
Right.
I'm here to talk to the people you're talking to.
Absolutely.
Right. And it's important to me that they hear my ideas. Exactly. And it's important to me that they hear my ideas for my ideas. And there are going to be places where you and I disagree. There are going to be places where you and I fully agree. Mm. And that's okay. Right. And it's important to me not to just say, you know, politics, as they say, is a game of addition. You've got to be able to be talking to a lot of people in a lot of different ways. This is the same reason that last week I went on Jesse Waters. You think Jesse Waters and I
agree with most things? I watched it.
Right? But I went on because I wanted to be able to talk to those folks who listen to Jesse Waters and say, look, I need you to hear me in my own words, mm-hmm. not what they're going to say about me on this channel like they talk about me like every 15 minutes.
I got to confess to you. I know interviewers haven't said this to you before. That's a damn good answer. I got to give you credit for that. That's a damn good answer, sir. I got to give it to you. I can't knock that. I mean, if you're going to answer that question, that's the way you answer that question. Let me transition to ICE, because you've said something about ICE on several occasions. I think you said the only way forward is to abolish ICE and start from scratch. What does that mean? How does that look? Why would you say that?
Yeah, let me be clear. I believe that we ought to have a safe, secure southern border. I believe that you ought to enforce immigration law, but not by masked men with AR-15s in contraposition to the law of the land itself, which is the Constitution. And let's be clear, we didn't have an ICE before this century, right? Like, it didn't exist before this century. People like to talk like it's part of the Constitution. It's not. The Constitution is the Constitution, and ICE sits counterposed to the Constitution. ICE is not about immigration. ICE is about making a show of immigration. It is about normalizing paramilitary force on our streets. And maybe it's because I've run government agencies, but when you get a culture of impunity that sets in to an agency, it becomes nearly impossible to root out. And so I think the answer is, yes, make the investments in border protection. Let's make the investments in a legal system, the kind of court infrastructure that we need to create a pathway to citizenship. Let's think about how we enforce immigration policy in the way that INS used to, back when immigration wasn't a thing we had to think about, in a way that is consistent with the laws of this land. We should not be shooting people in the back of the head or the face. We should not be invading preschools or hospitals or clinics in the name of immigration enforcement. Mm-hmm. We can have a humane system. And I think ICE has become part of the problem, not part of the solution. So I think we need to undo it and then ask, all right, how do we start thinking about or what should we build in its stead in a way where we're enforcing immigration policy, but not in a way that is destroying the Constitution itself?
Is there any condition under which you think open borders are acceptable?
No, I mean, you have to have borders that you can control. There's no question about that. What is a country? Like, if you'd have movement in and out, like at some point at some point, it's crazy to think that you would ever not have a closed border. But the key point of this is to say, people think ICE is about border enforcement. It's not. You have Customs and Border Protection. They enforce the border. ICE is something completely different. It's about immigration enforcement inside the country. And the way that they've been doing it has been killing people. I mean, I went to Minneapolis at the height of Project Metro Surge. Stephen A., I got to tell you, like, some of the things I saw, I never thought I would see in the United States of America. And we can't go back there. We can't allow that to continue to happen. And the way that we do that is to focus on a closed border, right, sustaining our border, while also making sure that any sort of customs enforcement or immigration enforcement is done in clear consistency with the Constitution.
I think from an optic perspective, from the peripheral, and from a more intimate perspective, based on what you saw with your own two eyes up close and personal, like you said, in Minnesota and other places, I don't think there's any question that we can't be tolerant of what we've been seeing happen. That's fair. But so many people point at Trump and his administration, what he campaigned on and what he's been doing and what they've been doing since he returned to office. What about the role that the former president, Joe Biden, played in having the borders open to begin with? Is there, what level of culpability do you attach to that?
Yeah, I mean, look, clearly that was a failure in policy. And clearly we need to learn from what happened there. But let me just be clear. Donald Trump came down that hideous golden escalator and he told us that every problem we had was because of immigrant. Out of a job, immigrant took your job. Out of healthcare, immigrant took your healthcare. Out of a home, immigrants living in your home. That was the whole, they're eating their cats and dogs thing. Remember that?
Yes.
And he used that to empower ICE now to create a paramilitary force, in effect, that's answerable only to him and other stooges in the White House like Stephen Miller. Right. Now, this is in contraposition to the ideals of the Constitution itself. I mean, we just celebrated our 250th anniversary, and it was about taking on tyranny. This is government tyranny. And ask yourself, can you afford your groceries or your gas now? Do you feel like your job is any more secure? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you have any better shot at ever owning a home? Can you see a doctor? Mm-hmm. They didn't solve any of your actual problems, right? And so I'm about trying to solve the problems that you see in your life. And those are the ones that have to do with your gas, your groceries, and the ability to see a doctor.
Well, I want to transition because I want to get to a subject that I know you want to get to. I'm a black man, obviously. I know a lot of black people in the state of Michigan. You're looking for their support. Chances are you'll get a lot of it. What do you want to say to black individuals in the state of Michigan about what you're bringing to the table for their community?
I mean, my commitment to black communities in Michigan didn't just start when I decided to run for office. I moved back from a 10-year track job after medical school at Columbia University to rebuild Detroit's health department after it had been shut down by a system of emergency management by which the state government took over the right to self-determination for predominantly black communities across the state. Detroit was one of them. They shut down a 185-year-old health department. All of my work has been about getting glasses for kids, taking on corporate polluters, eliminating medical debt. And think about who I was serving. Residents of Detroit, Michigan's and the country's, frankly, largest predominantly black city. Residents of many of the suburbs of Detroit that are predominantly black. So my commitment has always been around equity. Now, we got to get serious about the structural features that continue to rob communities of basic access. They're weaponizing against ideas like diversity and equity and inclusion. Why do we hate diversity, equity, and inclusion? They're trying to wed us to a system when it comes to public schooling where they take away a local school district, which is actually the idea of which started way back when my opponent was in the state legislature championing these ideas. You think about the fact that we still pay for school buildings based on property tax. Now, you know this, property tax is a function of property value, which is a function of historical redlining in communities like Southeast Michigan and Detroit in particular. And so if we're serious about actually building opportunity, we got to build opportunity. Rather than send your money to a corporation that tells you it's going to make 500 jobs, those jobs never appear. Why aren't we building revolving loan funds in local communities so folks can build generational wealth in these communities? Why are we still allowing old racial and residential redlining to pattern how we fund our schools? Why are we willing to have a conversation about reparations, right? How are we still in a system
Because we're 40
where,
trillion in debt.
well, the $40 trillion in debt part, like let's see who created
That's
that
all of
debt.
us. That's all. Every administration has contributed to debt.
But Stephen A., you know that that debt always grows more under Republicans because they do two things. They cut taxes for billionaires and they send us to wars we know have no business fighting. So what are we doing now? Right? One big ugly bill, cut taxes for billionaires and has us fighting a war we don't need to fight.
COVID
So if we're
too.
serious,
COVID too. That
COVID not
wasn't
a part of
a
that.
war. That was COVID's not a part of that.
But remember, that was also a Republican administration. Like, I mean, like a lot of that stimulus came out
All
of the
right.
Trump administration because they failed to manage the pandemic in the first place.
Last question. I know we got to get on out of here, and I appreciate your time. Thank you so much. You ain't gonna get into the fight with the Vice President of the United States, right? He told you to keep his wife's name out of your mouth. You ain't gonna get into a fight with the Vice President of the United States, are you?
Now, look, my anger with the Vice President of the United States is the fact that he is underwriting an administration that is making us poorer and sicker, underwriting public policies he knows are ridiculous. I mean, he wrote about them in Hillbilly Elegy. Remember that? Now we're fighting a stupid war with Iran he doesn't know how to get us out of. We've got a trade war with Canada. People in my state are paying $5,600 a year to underwrite his vanity. And the man knows better. That's the thing, the man knows better. And meanwhile, do you remember who brought wives into the whole thing? That was Donald Trump. Well, a couple of days after I was nominated, he tweeted a picture of him and his wife and me and my wife, trying to draw attention to the idea that somehow my wife is less American than his wife, except for my wife was born here and his wife wasn't. So I'm just saying that at the end of the day, if you don't want to talk about my wives, maybe you should talk to your boss about how he brought spouses into it. And if you want to raise this idea that somehow you're going to go talk to your papaw, who, God rest his soul, passed away a long time ago, to tell him about how he would be aghast that a guy with my name and my faith is running for office, is important to ask important questions about who else might not be included in his papaw's America. So I just think it's kind of important to pay
All right.
attention to hypocrisy, which is something J.D. Vance doesn't want to talk about.
Dr. Abdul El Sayed, Democratic candidate for the United States Senate out of the great state of Michigan. I got to get on out of here. Thank you for your time. I really appreciate it. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. As you see, I'm on film both sides. I give you an opportunity to speak, ask the question, let you speak your piece, and I hope that you come back soon. Anytime, you're welcome, my man. Thank you so much.
Would love that. Next time we've got to talk about why Jordan's the GOAT and the Pistons, okay?
Well, there's nothing a reason to talk about. We know he's the GOAT. We know that. You know basketball, so
There it
we
is.
know that. Take it easy, my man. All the best to you. See you
Appreciate you.
soon. One and only Dr. Abdul El Sayed right here with Straight Shooter with Stephen A.